Montana's senior senator may have a new job in China. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has an update on the case of an illegal immigrant who alleges he was raped in a Montana jail. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with a staff writer with the Weekly Standard magazine about former Governor Brian Schweitzer's possible bid for the presidency. Democratic officials say President Barack Obama intends to nominate Montana Senator Max Baucus as ambassador to China. The nomination is subject to Senate confirmation. The Democrat had announced earlier this year that he would not seek re-election. The 72-year-old Baucus is chairman of the Senate Finance Committee with jurisdiction over taxes, trade, and other areas. He was instrumental in efforts to pass Obama's health care law 4 years ago and has spent much of this year seeking to build support for a sweeping overhaul of the tax code. There was no immediate comment from the White House. The officials spoke on condition of anonymity because they weren't authorized to publicly discuss the nomination in advance of Obama's announcement. A spokeswoman for Senator Baucus would only confirm he has been under consideration for the post. If confirmed before the end of next year, Baucus would resign his seat and create a vacancy that Montana Governor Steve Bullock, a Democrat, would fill. Lieutenant Governor John Walsh has announced he will run for the seat and will likely be a top candidate.
And in other news from around the state, a series of prayer vigils are being held around the state for a Mexican man who says he was raped while in custody at a Montana jail in October. Undocumented immigrant Odamio Orozco Ramirez was detained after a routine traffic stop in Sidney, Montana. Orozco Ramirez is not able to work while the investigation is ongoing. The vigils seek justice and solace for Orozco Ramirez and his family. His lawyer wonders if Orozco Ramirez will be deported before the case can be heard. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has the story.
God be with us tonight as we pray for Mr. Orozco Ramirez.
It's a small group, maybe 10.
Let us seek at least to find respect for all people.
A group of 10 standing in a circle in Helena's First United Church of Christ, hearing from a couple of local religious leaders.
We pray that there may also be a new birth of justice and love.
And hearing more about the story of Audemio Orozco Ramirez. His lawyer, Shahed Hawk Hausrath, describes how on October 4th, Orozco Ramirez was a passenger in a car driving in Sidney, Montana, which was pulled over for speeding.
Normally when a vehicle is pulled over for speeding, the driver might be given a ticket and the passenger would never be asked any questions, but that's not what happened here.
Hawk Hausrath alleges the Sidney Police Department has a policy in place to check the immigration status of Latinos as a standard procedure. The Sidney Police Department denies there is such a policy. Orozco Ramirez was detained and was in the process of being deported in the early morning hours of October 5th.
On his first night in detention in the Jefferson County Jail in Boulder, Montana, he was the victim of a violent sexual assault.
Orozco Ramirez wasn't able to report the alleged rape for a couple more days when he spoke to a Spanish-speaking official at an Idaho detention facility. Attorney Hawk Hausrath says it took days to convince customs officials not to deport him.
You guys can't deport this guy while you're investigating the sexual assault. If you deport him, you're never going to be able to seek justice for what happened to him.
But Hawk Hausrath says it all seems open-ended right now. How long officials will wait before deportation?
We don't know whether they're going to deport him once they get some kind of preliminary conclusion on anything. We don't really know what we're dealing with.
Customs officials say they take allegations of sexual assault seriously and are working closely with the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, as well as conducting their own investigation. Orozco Ramirez was released from jail 12 days after his arrest. Now, in the meantime, Hawk Hausrath says his client is a man with a wife and 7 children who is not allowed to work to feed them, a man who has been in the U.S. for 20 years, albeit illegally. Hawk Hausrath says he himself does not know if prayer works, but he's sure vigils like this can have impact.
If you're praying for him, that means you're thinking about him. It means you're paying attention to what happened.
Another vigil has already been held in Billings. Others are planned for Butte and Bozeman, with more in the works. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Three life-sized horse sculptures rustled from a herd of 39 displayed on a hillside in southwestern Montana have turned up on a nearby ranch with only minor damage. Broadwater County Deputy Brandon Harris tells the Bozeman Daily Chronicle a rancher checking on his cattle south of Townsend yesterday afternoon spotted some tracks in the snow in an area not normally traveled. He followed the tracks and spotted the steel sculptures of two horses and a colt. Harris says the rancher did not know the artwork had been reported missing until he spoke with friends in town later that night. Belgrade sculptor Jim Dolan says he plans to make some minor repairs and return the horses to the hillside near Three Forks. Harris says there are no suspects in the theft.
A judge has dismissed a lawsuit by the charity co-founded by Three Cups of Tea author Greg Mortensen against an insurance company. U.S. District Judge Dana Christensen dismantled the lawsuit Thursday, more than a month after the Central Asia Institute and Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance Company reached a settlement. The charity sued over the costs associated with defending a Montana investigation into Mortensen's management of the Central Asia Institute and a civil lawsuit against Mortensen and the CAI. The insurance company agreed to pay $1.2 million in a settlement reached in November. The case's dismissal marks an end to more than 2 years of legal troubles for Mortensen after 60 Minutes and author John Krakauer published reports alleging Mortensen fabricated parts of his best-selling book and mismanaged the charity.
Former Montana Supreme Court Justice Brian Morris has been sworn in as the state's newest federal judge. Chief U.S. District Judge Dana Christensen swore in the 50-year-old Morris today in a ceremony at the Montana Supreme Court chambers packed by prominent lawyers, judges, and politicians. Morris told the crowd his departure from the state court for the federal bench is bittersweet. The U.S. Senate last week confirmed Morris's and State District Judge Susan Waters' nominations. Waters is to take the oath tomorrow in Billings. Morris has been a Supreme Court justice since 2005 and was reelected in 2012 to a new 8-year term. His replacement on the state court will have to be confirmed by the Montana Senate in 2015. The seat will be up for election in 2016.
Sunburst Middle School has won a $20,000 technology grant as part of a national project by Samsung to raise student interest in science, technology, engineering, and math. Kim Block, a teacher in the school's Gifted and Talented program, applied for the grant, which required her to create a science-related lesson plan meant to address a community concern. Block wants the students to study an alkali flat south of Sunburst. When a boggy area dries out, winds can blow salt across the interstate, causing reduced visibility and even whiteout conditions. The school district's speech pathologist died in a multiple vehicle crash there in May. Four members of Sunburst High's golf team were also injured. Block says the Samsung Technology Grant presented a wonderful opportunity.
In thinking about what happened in May and thinking about the agricultural situation up here, I just thought, well, I know what would really engage these kids and, you know, give them an opportunity to make a difference and solve a problem. And so I wrote about that. I had to answer three questions. You know, how would you engage the kids? What community problem could you solve? And what are your technology needs? So in 100 words or less, for each of those three questions, I put together a plan that would engage the kids in using science, in using technology, in using engineering and math, and the community problem we could solve.
Block says students are excited that their research might be able to save lives. More with Block later this week on Montana Evening Edition.
Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks killed a mountain lion south of Missoula last Saturday. FWP officials believe the lion could be the same animal spotted multiple times this fall in the Miller Creek area. FWP Regional Wildlife Manager Mike Thompson says the 110-pound subadult male was behaving unnaturally and posed a safety risk to people at their residences. FWP responded to a report from a homeowner who found the lion had killed a mule deer fawn among houses on Oral Zumwalt Way.
A 4-year-old male grizzly bear was briefly caught in a steel leg-hold wolf trap near the Rocky Mountain front west of Dupuyer. Fish, Wildlife, and Parks grizzly bear management specialist Mike Madel says two men were checking wolf traps yesterday afternoon when they discovered the bear with its foot in the trap. The bear had pulled the trap out of the ground, but the trap became entangled in a tree and some brush. According to the Great Falls Tribune, the trapper reported the accidental capture to the state wildlife officials, who immobilized the 473-pound bear with a dart gun and removed the trap. Madel planned to relocate the bear, which was not seriously injured other than swelling of the toe joints. Madel says the trapper set the traps properly.
Cross-country skiers and other users headed to the Lake Como Recreation Area near Darby will see some new signs reminding trappers their traps must be set 150 feet back from the trails and recommending they not set traps in the area at all. The signs are the result of a partnership among the Forest Service, State Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, the Como Trails Club, and the Montana Trapping Association. Trapping in an area heavily used by skiers and their dogs has become contentious. Darby District Ranger Chuck Oliver says although trapping has a long history there, other uses have increased in recent years.
When I first started here about 9 years ago, there was very little use in the winter associated with the Lake Como area at all. It has been increasing over the years, and since the ski area has been developed, cross-country ski area, over the last 4 years, we've really seen a significant increase of use out in that area.
The Forest Service says, in fact, Lake Como is the most visited recreation area in Region 1. Oliver says the agency continues to work on a long-term solution.
What we're trying to do is work with the ski club and the Trapping Association, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and try to come up with a solution that's going to work for everybody. They all would have an opportunity to have a part in helping us come up with whatever that long-term solution was going to be.
The new signs will be posted throughout the cross-country ski area.
Montana's gray wolf season around the town of Gardner ends 30 minutes after sunset tomorrow after hunters filled a four-wolf quota in the area near Yellowstone National Park. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks spokesman Ron Osheim says the closure applies to both hunting and trapping in Wolf Management Area 313. That's one of two areas near Yellowstone where hunting has been restricted following requests from federal park officials. The only other place in Montana with restrictions on how many wolves can be shot is west of Glacier National Park, where there's a two-wolf quota. Hunters statewide have reported shooting 106 wolves since the season began September 7th. Wolf hunting ends March 15th. Trappers have three wolves so far in a season that began Sunday and runs through February 28th.
A 450-ton shipment of oil field equipment delayed by protests and bad weather in eastern Oregon got permission from state officials for a daylight run yesterday. It traveled 50 miles at elevations above 4,000 feet, where the state said ice was feared after dark. The transport is headed for the Canadian tar sands oil development and has to pull off frequently to let traffic by and had been restricted to night travel. A spokeswoman for the moving company, Holly Zander, said the transport is due back on the road tonight and could be in Vail tomorrow. On Monday night, 16 people were arrested near John Day, Oregon, after environmentalists tried to block the rig. They say the tar sands development will contribute to global warming.
Former Governor Brian Schweitzer says he plans to spend a lot of time in Iowa, and in fact, he's giving a speech there today, raising more questions about whether he intends to run for president. In a recent article in the conservative Weekly Standard magazine, Schweitzer says he's, quote, interested, end quote, in running. In this feature interview, Weekly Standard staff writer Michael Warren tells news director Sally Mock that he became interested in writing about the former governor precisely because Schweitzer might want to run for the nation's highest office.
Particularly someone who might want to run for president as an outsider, I guess the moment I thought, hey, I should write something on this guy or at least find out a little more, was I saw a clip of him on MSNBC on a weekend TV show there, and he was just doing an interview and talking about his views on healthcare reform and the Democratic Party and, you know, the things that he did as governor of Montana, and I thought, hey, this guy sounds like he wants to run for president.
So you gave him a call and talked to him for quite a while, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's right. He actually called me. I was looking to see, well, when he's on the East Coast, of course, I'm based in Washington, D.C. When he's on the East Coast next, maybe I can, go up to New York or see him here in D.C. and have some time. And so I got in touch with his assistant and asked him, can you get me in touch? And then a couple hours later, Schweitzer called me himself and said, hey, I heard you wanted to talk. So we talked for a little over an hour and learned a lot about him. And he was talking to me about just his positions and views on all sorts of things. It sort of reinforced my view that this is somebody who wants to at least flirt with the idea of running for president and being on the national scene.
You wrote in your article about the governor that he wants to, quote, position himself as the progressive populist wing of the Democratic Party.
That's right. It seems to me that the best way for a Democratic would-be candidate to position himself for 2016 is in response to Hillary Clinton. I think everybody believes that Hillary Clinton is going to run for president and has a very good opportunity to win the nomination and win the presidency. So how do you break through? I think you have to differentiate yourself. He's, I think, arguing that he is a progressive, that he is more progressive, more liberal than Hillary Clinton is, that he speaks for a more progressive viewpoint within the party, and also that that he's a populist, that he is attempting to appeal to the people, as opposed to Hillary Clinton, who he might argue, or other Democrats might argue, appeals too much to a sort of a Wall Street third way new Democrat, much like her husband Bill Clinton. He's definitely positioning himself as the anti Hillary Clinton in that sense. So I think combined with his political profile in Montana, in which I think I mentioned some of the things that that your listeners would know about, his veto cattle brand and some of the other very populist stunts he pulled as governor, I think that all that combines with his political identity, and that's who he is, and that's the kind of candidate I think he would be.
Certainly Montana Democrats would agree that he was a populist governor. There are a lot of progressive Montana Democrats who would take issue with labeling the governor progressive, especially on environmental issues, since he is so unabashedly pro-coal.
That's right, and as I also point out in the piece, he's also unabashedly pro-Second Amendment, which not only progressives in Montana, I imagine progressives across the country would might balk at his candidacy for being so sort of pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun. I think his favorite quote about gun control is, "You control yours, I'll control mine." It doesn't sound like somebody who's going to win the hearts and minds of Democratic base voters. But I think on economic issues, Brian Schweitzer is a progressive. He talks about the corporate influence in both parties. He doesn't like it. He likes to portray himself, I think, as a Democrat who stands up for the little guy. He certainly comes from, I think, a tradition, the sort of union tradition in Montana that that a lot of the Democratic Party in Montana draws its from that history. So maybe not the type of progressive some diehards in Montana might want to see as president, but on a national stage, I think he's got a lot of maybe cross party, cross cultural appeal. People always say on the left that that people are voting for Republicans for cultural reasons, but not for economic reasons. Well, Brian Schweitzer, I think, might be a Democrat who appeals to, you know, maybe more culturally conservative folks, or at least culturally traditional folks, but who may feel that they're getting the raw end of the economic stick here. And in that way, I think he definitely appeals to a sort of progressive view of income inequality and economic fairness.
He likes to refer to the two parties as the corporate party and the corporate light party.
Right. That was a great description. And so it's clearly somebody who's trying to run as an outsider. And again, I think if you're going to run against Hillary Clinton and the political machine she has, the fundraising machine, I don't think those are insurmountable obstacles. But you do have to run as an outsider, and I think he is making the case for himself. We'll see if anybody's buying.
It's interesting, a recent public policy poll shows that among Montana Democrats, Hillary Clinton would easily beat Governor Brian Schweitzer, who was, as you said, a popular governor here.
Well, I think a lot of that may have to do with the fact that nobody's really thought about Brian Schweitzer as a presidential candidate. Look, that probably cuts against the argument for Brian Schweitzer a little bit. But you never know how these things can go, especially this far out from 2016. We're living in a post-Citizens United world where super PACs can raise a whole bunch of money and put their money behind candidates. We saw that a lot in the 2012 Republican primary, but not much, obviously, in the Democratic primary because Barack Obama was unopposed. I think you're going to start seeing in Democratic and liberal circles the same sort of thing happening. You'll have maybe a liberal billionaire or two who decides that Brian Schweitzer's their guy and can get him through, you know, the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary and a few of the other early primaries, and all of a sudden he's looking stronger than even his own fellow Montanans thought. So we're still a long way off. I think my piece sort of just makes the argument that that there's somebody out there saying, I'm not the Hillary Clinton, I'm not the Barack Obama for 2016. I'm sort of the anti-Hillary Clinton and the Democratic outsider.
As your article points out, and as you've mentioned, Governor Schweitzer has a flamboyant streak. How do you think that would play nationally? The last couple of Democratic presidential candidates don't fit that category.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I also think that sort of thinking more broadly about the Democratic presidential candidates, the old saw is that Republicans fall in line and Democrats fall in love. And there's a long history of not necessarily flamboyant, but different candidates sort of getting the attention and love of the Democratic base. So I think that Brian Schweitzer is different. I think he has some appeal. You know, I mentioned that MSNBC or that television appearance in which Brian Schweitzer was talking about his time as governor of Montana, and the big sort of idea was that he's a liberal or progressive or at least a Democrat running and winning in a relatively conservative state. So I think that he shares a lot of similarities in that way with Bill Clinton. Maybe he's a little more flamboyant than Bill Clinton was, I could see him as being the type of candidate who could fire up the base. I mean, we saw that again with Howard Dean in 2004. Barack Obama, maybe not flamboyant, but he's certainly able to rile up a crowd and get people excited. And I think that Brian Schweitzer has the opportunity to get people excited about voting for somebody. You know, Hillary Clinton's run again. She's sort of, in many ways, definitely a veteran to the political scene. If Democrats by 2016 are looking for something new, they may see the sort of pizzazz coming from Brian Schweitzer and say, hey, why not him?
Well, your article, Mr. Warren, certainly raised the question that everybody in Montana is asking, and that is, what is Brian Schweitzer's political future at this point? And I have been speaking with Michael Warren, staff writer for the Weekly Standard, who has a new article out about whether Governor Brian Schweitzer will run for president. Mr. Warren, thanks so much. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Now for tonight's forecast. There is a winter weather advisory in effect across our entire listening area. That advisory is in effect west of the Divide until 11 a.m. tomorrow. In central and southwestern Montana, that advisory is in effect until noon tomorrow. That advisory will be for snow. West of the Divide, there's also a winter storm warning in effect until 5 a.m. tomorrow for the West Glacier region. Tonight, snow showers are likely with areas of blowing snow. Expect lows 7 to 14 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs 16 to 23 degrees. In central Montana tonight, expect snow with lows 5 below 0 to 0 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 40 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy in the morning, then become partly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs 5 to 15 degrees. Southwest Montana tonight, expect snow with lows 5 to 15 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy. Snow is likely through the day with highs in the teens. And now for the editorial comments of Mary Sheehy Moe.
Of all the tasks involved in being a school board member, certainly the most pleasant is attending holiday concerts. Every year I drop in on school programs throughout Great Falls, and this year I've been focusing on the elementary schools. The talent and sophistication are certainly more evident in the high schools, but in the elementary schools, every child is part of the program. And for a couple of hours, you get to be part of the unique mini-community that develops around the hub of a neighborhood school. Every venue is packed with parents, grandparents, and preschool brothers and sisters. The program usually begins with the kindergartners, who file into the multipurpose room completely awestruck by the crowd. Then they spot a family member and start waving wildly, and the family members respond in kind, and it takes about 5 minutes of concerted intervention by the music teacher and the kindergarten teacher and the principal to get the kids up on the risers and the families back in their seats. The older the group of students, the less distracted they are by their families. By the time the sixth graders enter, it's clear that they will be mortified by anything beyond eye contact, and their parents respect their wishes, most of them. The mom beside me at Sunnyside Elementary elbowed her husband when he beckoned to their sixth-grade son. "Don't you dare," she whispered fiercely. "You'll embarrass him." Discipline, teamwork, and creativity come into play at every level. For kindergartners, just getting lined up on the risers without mishap requires practice. Keeping them focused on the task at hand is a challenge. "Look at my antlers, Grandma," a little boy at Riverside School cried out just before his class belted out Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. But when the teacher clapped her hands, signaling that they were about to begin, all eyes were on her. With each progressive age group, the music gets more challenging and the roles more individualized. There are partner songs and speaking roles and even a solo or two. You've heard the songs a million times, and they're often shouted rather than sung, with occasional clarinet squeaks, but the crowd couldn't be more enraptured by the Boston Pops. Many people's understanding of music education boils down to these holiday programs. They like music in the schools, but often view it as a frill, a cheerful little extra that makes the kids feel good, and the public as well. When budgets get tight or when some new alarmist report raises the cry for more emphasis on the academics, music programs are too often the first to be watered down or eliminated entirely. But music education is more than an annual rendering of jingle bells. Language development during the early years is critical to kids' academic success and social competence. Music training physically develops the left side of the brain, which processes language, making kids more nuanced in their own language and more receptive to others. Music instruction also develops spatial intelligence, helping children visualize elements that should go together, like they do when solving math problems. Research shows that students in high-quality music programs score better on standardized tests, have better attendance records, and are more likely to complete high school. But that's not the main reason I think music education, delivered by properly credentialed teachers, is so important in our public schools. Nor is it because students involved in music learn that practice really does make perfect. Or because singing in a choir or playing in an orchestra teaches teamwork in a powerfully authentic way. Or because the study of music necessarily exposes children to cultures and heritages different from their own. The thing that impresses me most about kids immersed in making music is their emotional intelligence. You cannot sing P.A. Jesu without understanding on a visceral level the tremendous sorrow of losing a loved one. You cannot sing Kosi Sikaleli Africa without understanding the yearning of a beleaguered people. You cannot play Beethoven's Ninth without sensing that such transcendent joy rises or is perhaps negotiated through discord and despair. Hopefully, school-aged children have not yet experienced such sorrow, such yearning, such discord. But someday they will, and if they've had a rich music education, they'll have a reservoir of light to draw from in those dark days. I leave every holiday program happy, surrounded by happy people, inspired, knowing that the good things we see in December are but the tip of music education iceberg, and grateful for Montana's music teachers who put off their own holiday season to fill ours with joy. This is Mary Sheehy Moe, retired, but still advocating for free, quality public education in Montana.
Mary Sheehy Moe is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening.